You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Towinski and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats. Today, we have got another potluck for you. This is actually, we're kind of like in between seasons right now. The last episode you listened to was Scott and I saying the next episode will be a new season. But then we also realized we forgot to record an extra episode or two. So we're in between seasons right now, and we've got another potluck for you because we took like a month off, and the potluck questions have just been coming in. So we'll get into it just a sec. Today we are sponsored by Sentry and FreshBooks. We'll talk about them partway through the episode. How you doing today, Scott?
Hey, I'm doing good. In between seasons here, season 1.5, whatever you want to call it. I'm doing good. It's going to take a little bit to get back into the podcasting, but I've been doing a lot of recording, so it's not like I haven't been talking into a microphone. I'm excited to get into some of these potluck questions. It seemed like there was a lot of great stuff in here. So yeah, do you want to kick it off with number one?
Yes, a question. And this is something I've got a lot of questions about from Low Key. Is what are your guys' thoughts on the Mozilla layoffs and how it will affect developers? So if you didn't hear, Mozilla, because of coronavirus, their income has dramatically dropped. And they had to lay off, 25% of their workforce, which was something like 250 devs. It looked like all of the people that were laid off, they worked in dev tools, they worked on the browser. Like the entire team that works on Firefox's dev tools was just laid off. And all the folks that work on MDN, the docs, were laid off. A lot of the developer advocates, the people that work in the CSS working group and all that, they were all laid off, which is a huge blow to, I think, just the web development in general. And I just kind of have this like sick to my stomach feeling about it. So thoughts about that? I think that's a major bummer that sort of the one company that we always sort of relied on to keep it real and like sort of keep that flame alive, because they're really the only company against Google. I guess like Apple has their own browser as well. So maybe that's not entirely true, but I was kind of bummed to see that, especially because like the entire DevTools team was laid off, and I've been a Firefox user for, I don't know, maybe 9 months, and I've been loving the DevTools, but like at what point is it just going to start to decay and then I'm going to have to switch back, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think Firefox is going away. I don't know. The whole thing is just very hard to tell what the long-term effects of this are going to be, considering that it is such a big hit to the web overall as we know it, especially the web as many of us would like to know it, you know, without being consistently tracked by, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and whoever, right? So I don't know. The whole business is not good. I don't know what to say other than, man, we'll just have to, I don't know, be tracking the repercussions of this for a long time, the amount of talent they let go. I don't know what you know about Rust, Wes. Do you know a whole lot about Rust?
Not a whole lot, no. I know that like Firefox was built in that, but that's about it.
I think parts of Firefox are built in it. Rust, it's like a language, a systems language that is, I've been using it for a little bit now just to learn a new language, and it has enough stuff in line with TypeScript to feel at home, but in the same regard, it is a much more difficult language than anything I've written before in the past. Either way, Rust is largely developed out of Mozilla. So there was obviously a big concern over that, considering the WASM stuff. There's like a lot of very web, essentially dire consequences of potentially removing some of these people. However, it does seem like the majority of the core team of Rust is still there. So that at least is good. But man, you can't feel like, I don't know, there's just so many facets of the web overall that this touches, whether it is the WASM stuff or it is the documentation, the MDN docs or the dev tools themselves, which are always getting better. Man, I don't know what to tell you. I've been using Brave for a little bit here, so I haven't exactly been on the Firefox train super hard. But man, I do love those dev tools, and hopefully they figure something out to regain some of that talent.
Yeah, we should say that like MDN is not going anywhere. MDN, right, for a long time has been a joint partnership between Google and a couple other their companies as well. They've even put out a blog post saying, like, don't worry, we're not going anywhere. But like Mozilla did employ people just to work on the docs full time. So certainly the effort of those people probably won't be full time anymore unless a sort of another company can scoop them up. I did see, I'm not sure if this was related or not to what we're talking about, but I did see Jen Simmons, who part of CSS Working Group, huge advocate for all of the new layout stuff. And she works a lot on all of the new layout stuff that we get, Flexbox Grid, I think container queries, a lot of stuff like that. She's working at Safari now, which that made me feel so good. I'm like, oh, Safari cares. Like they hired her, and she's asking all kinds of stuff on Twitter about like what you want to see in Safari. And maybe Safari will now get a sort of catch up to where the other browsers are.
Yeah, I've been actually using Safari a bit more than usual because since I got the iPhone, you know, the good thing about the Apple phone is that like, if you use all of Apple's software, then like, then the phone works very, very well. And if you start trying to use the other people's software, it doesn't work as well because of Apple's guardians that they put in the software, right? Whether it is the browser things where it's like not true Chrome that you're running on the iPhone compared to the Android. Like, I've been using Safari and it's not terrible. There are a lot of things I like it. In fact, in the latest Level Up Tutorials course that I'm recording right now, I'm using Safari as the browser.
Oh, nice.
But for no reason, because the dev tools aren't as good. But I'm using Safari specifically just because the tab bar is smaller at the top and it takes up less screen space. But I've been sprinkling it in here and there, and it's good. I'm glad that the Safari team is open to growing the browser in these sort of ways. In the same regard, I wish it wasn't so hard to publish an extension on the Safari web extension store, because you have to pay money and get an Apple developer's account and have it all those things. So I don't know. We'll see. Safari is still good, but there's a lot of like critical, like, I don't know, deficiencies with it. Like the fact that it doesn't update outside of a actual operating system update.
Like, those like remind me tomorrow. That's really frustrating, because like what we're talking about is that, you know, if you have a Mac, you get this pop up every single day that says there's updates, and every single person presses remind me tomorrow for the eternity.
Because it's never the right time. It's not the right time. I got stuff to do.
And if you want to update your browser, that's the only way you can update your browser. And that's exactly like, when did that ever happen before? Remember IE6? You know,
do you remember we had a, I don't know if you were involved, but I had a thing on Twitter where I was tweeting about this thing that didn't work in Safari. And they were like, somebody from the Safari team was just like, make sure your browser's on this version and you have to update your OS. I updated my OS and it worked. It's like, oh, I never thought like that, you know, until now. Well, I guess I did in the past, but not recently.
Yeah. And that's not to say I hate when people say Safari is the new IE, because there are lots of good people working on it that are genuinely concerned with this stuff. But
I say that, but I don't mean to put anybody down. And I feel like the browser is very good. There's just like there, whenever I have a bug, it's always because of Safari, not because of Mozilla or Chrome. And, you know, whatever. It again, it's not the new IE by any means, but I get where you're coming from. That was a long answer to Loki's banger of a first question. Next question is from Brian M. He asks, first of all, love listening to your show. Thank you, Brian. It has definitely motivated to get my career started. Right now, I am a math teacher. I'm married with two kids, and so finding time to code is difficult. Our kids are the same age, so yes, it is difficult. My current situation includes waking up at 4:30 a.m. just to get some time in before the kids wake up. Do you either of you have any tips about finding the balance between raising kids, getting stuff done around the house, having a full-time job, and trying to teach yourself web development to transition into a different career? Yeah. So I don't know what your wife's schedule is like, because my wife is home. She's currently working. We're both working full-time. And even though I get to code for a living, there is a lot of stuff maybe after hours that I would like to do as well, coding-wise, or even just hobbies or projects or those kind of things. Time to learn something. And I found it's been very difficult to find that time. Now, I do not have the dedication to wake up at 4:30 a.m. to do that. And that's awesome. But really, that is the answer. The answer is find some time, just find some time when you have any inkling of energy and there is no one to distract you, to build in that time. I really don't know. My wife and I have gotten really, really hardcore with our schedules lately, and it's definitely helped make sure everybody knows what's going on, when and where and how. But to be honest, unless it's before the kids wake up or after the kids go to bed, unless your partner has the ability to step in and hang out with the kids for, you know, a couple hours here and there on some sort of agreement, and you pick up the tab at a later time, man, I don't know, that it is a tough time to raise or to like find that time. One thing I might suggest is if you can listen to, you know, whether it is video tutorials or have something on the TV or a podcast like Syntax, like listen to this stuff in the time that you're doing your day-to-day job. So maybe you can double dip a little bit in terms of like learning if you are able to learn while you're a math teacher. Oof. I don't know if you're like grading papers and you can do that on a robot mode or something like that. I really honestly don't know. I'm not a teacher, but if you can find some time to at least get a little bit of double dipping in, I guess that's the only other solution. It's a tough one, Brian.
Yeah, that's, I think that you're on the right track, is something's got to give at some point. And we've talked about this before, but I think it's fine for there to be times in your life where like you probably sit down with your significant other and say like, look, like I'm trying to make a career change here. This is going to be tough for the next year or two or however long you think that it's going to take you before you can make that jump to either doing freelance projects or to getting an entry level job in that type of thing. And really it's just about being on the same page with your significant other and being like, I need, like right now, because of COVID, all of our kids are home. Mm-hmm. And my wife is still trying to work her job, but she has to like take care of them Monday to Friday. So like, what do we have to do in that case? Well, I'm taking them every single morning while she goes and works out. And then I give her half an hour every single day where I jump in and she goes, does a little bit of work here, there. And then she tries to squeeze them in when one of the kids is sleeping and you throw the iPads in front of the kid. And then every single Saturday, I take the kids myself and I just like take them out of the house somewhere. So she has quiet and is able to do some filming. So like, it's not even close to like the best possible situation or compared to what we used to have when kids would go to school and things like that. But we're sort of just making it work. And it's not the most fun thing because I obviously would like to hang out a little bit more, but these are the times and she's trying to keep her thing going while these kids are home. So you just gotta like eke away little hunks of time here and there and have understanding with your significant other.
Yeah, that's really what's important. And Courtney and I have been, like I said, we've been really scheduling stuff lately. And I think it's helped quite a bit. So just so everybody's on the same page, we're utilizing the calendar more. These are your mm-hmm. times because now that she's fully back at work, it's like, oh, we both have like 40 hours a week to put in plus. So it's trying to find those times is especially difficult right now.
Yeah, I can't wait till these kids go back to school, or hopefully schools don't close again.
Yeah, right. Good luck, Brian. You can do it.
Yes, good job. Next question we have here is from Diana Garcia. If you have used a drag and drop framework using React, which one would you choose? I've never used this, nor do I know of any, actually. Scott, have you done this?
Yeah, I have. There's a whole bunch, and I've used a whole bunch of them because, you know, I like to try out stuff like this. What's the biggest one, the most popular one is React D&D, not React Dungeons and Dragons. This is React D&D is probably the most popular one. And this is a very, very good, like full service solution here. It has, let's see, 14,000 stars on GitHub. So it's got a big community, lots of people using it. I don't know how small this thing is. The fact that they're not advertising its size means it's probably a little bit heftier. Then there's also React Beautiful D&D from Atlassian. Atlassian, is that how you always pronounce that company's name? Yeah, okay. I never have to say it out loud. And this one's nice. It's definitely like they try to say, hey, this is very like Trello-like. This has got the stuff, the kind of experiences that you'd want. And again, they are not offering the size super easily here. They're not showing exactly how big. And most of these libraries seem like they are a little hefty. So this is my recommendation. If you need a lot of drag and drop stuff, like a lot of flexibility, a lot of drag and drop stuff, go with the React Beautiful D&D or React D&D. Either one of those is going to be just fine. That said, if you are potentially using animations throughout your site and maybe you just need a draggable list, then I would take a look at just using something like Framer Motion or React Spring, because either one of those, Framer Motion or React Spring, allows you to do some really nice, beautiful drag and drop stuff fairly easily itself without having to introduce another library just to do drag and drop. So that's what we do on Level Up Tutorials. All of our drag and drop is done through Framer Motion, and it's not too, too bad. In fact, we'll be doing that in a video tutorial that I'm working on this month. But that's beyond the point. I think if you have an animation solution already in place, use an animation solution. If you don't, use a dedicated library. I wouldn't code your own from scratch without either of those two things, I think.
Next question is from Ali. End-to-end testing versus visual regression testing. At which web app development cycle should you implement each of these, the best tools versus open source? So I'm going to pass this one off to Scott, because I know you have a lot of opinions on this as well.
Yeah, so E2E versus visual regression testing. E2E stands for end-to-end testing versus visual regression testing. Typically in end-to-end testing situations, what you're doing is loading up the application as it is and as it's being used by the users. Some frameworks for this would be like Cypress. And with Cypress, it physically shows you a browser window of an actual Chrome browser or Mozilla Firefox browser using the application. And then you use any sort of jQuery or whatever the like syntax is for actually manipulating the site. Okay, you find this element, make sure it exists. Okay, now you find this element, you click on it, and now it should take you to this page. So end-to-end testing is largely making sure that the application works and shows up as expected, as it is like rendered in a real browser. Where visual regression testing is, as the name might suggest, is straight up visual testing. Like let's say you have thousands of pages, you take a screenshot of those pages and say, this is how these pages should look. Then maybe you change the CSS in another page and you update that visual test. But that CSS change had unexpected consequences on another page. What visual regression testing is going to do is let you know that, hey, something that you didn't expect to change visually changed visually by a change that you made. So while end-to-end testing is largely focused on like the actual user interactions and the functionality of the site, visual regression testing is straight up like visual testing, or like the testing of visual elements on your site. The thing is that I think you can do visual regression testing in Cypress as well.
I really
have not done so. There are, I went to, what was the conference? It was Develop Denver a couple of years ago when I was speaking at it. And there was a really neat talk on like Cypress superpowers or something like that. And it was like a paid extension. So I didn't get to try it because you had to sign up for some sort of service. But yeah, they were doing straight up visual regression testing in it. And it seemed very cool. I was super into the with general way that they were doing it, but obviously it was a little bit overkill for something like me. At which stage in app development cycle do you implement them? I implement ETE as we let go, as we complete a feature. Like yeah. I'm not doing test-driven development with end-to-end testing. But when a feature's done, one thing that we do is we have like an ETE test that all it does is just hit every single view on the site, like every single page or type of page. That way we can see if there's just like any generic loading bugs on any individual page. So like the moment I create a page or a route or something, we'll always add it to the E2E testing. So I E2E test as you go. We do not do any visual regression testing. I can imagine if you would, you would probably do that at the very end of a production application, because man, things are going to change visually a lot when you're working on it. That's for sure. So I wouldn't do that until the very end of like, or only on production.
I do the Cypress as I finish a piece of functionality, and I haven't done visual regression testing in probably 5 years. And when I did use it, it was awesome because it would literally show you the diffs of pages that changed. But it was at the time, it was like sometimes it wouldn't work, or sometimes the font wouldn't load in time, mm-hmm. or sometimes it was a little bit different, and it was annoying enough that you'd be like, ah, it failed. It's probably just another thing. And you have to go force it through and be like, it's fine. But I bet it's better now because it's like we've had major leaps and bounds in headless Chrome, which can just take screenshots for you. There's this thing called Percy.io. I've never tried it, but I've heard a lot about it. I want to try it out at some point because that's usually like that's not necessarily a huge problem that I have, but it's nice to know that if you're adding a quick little bit of CSS, you're not accidentally nuking something else on the right. website. Or even yeah. even with JavaScript, if you're writing a server rendered React application and you goof up some JavaScript, then you, of course you're going to see something different spit out on the page. So that's key as well.
Yeah, totally. Next question is from Rob Dominguez. He says, I teach a high school course in web development for a group of students who have a solid knowledge of HTML and CSS and a decent understanding of JavaScript. Would Svelte be a good framework entering into component-based development for the first time? Love the show. Thanks for the tips. Thank you, Rob. So my thoughts on this are, yes, I think Svelte would be a good option for that because it's not too lot like when you're learning React, there's so many little React gotchas, right? There's so many little React things, even though there is like the quote unquote just JavaScript aspect of React. You do get better at JavaScript from React. I think there are a lot of little things that are going to throw people off, especially if you have an HTML and CSS background. When I like to think about Svelte, yes, Svelte is different than HTML and CSS, but it reminds me a lot of in Angular 1, how it was really easy to say, oh, you know, here is some HTML. And guess what? We just sprinkle in some like interesting little additional attributes on this. And all of a sudden it's a loop. That is probably a little bit easier to learn first and foremost. I remember really finding it easy to learn Angular 1 specifically when it wasn't all about having to work around the Angular or the framework or directives. No, it was all about, all right, you just throw something on scope and now you get a loop and whatever, and you get to really understand in a way that is a little bit easier. To me, it seems like Svelte is even like a nice little stepping stone into working in dynamic HTML and JavaScript overall. But so, yeah, I would think Svelte is a great option for that, especially just because, again, it is mirroring the HTML so nicely and it makes the interactivity parts of it fairly simple comparatively to React.
I was going to say all of those things. So ditto. So a question from Eric is, what is a good Google Analytics alternative in 2020? I have a site on Netlify, but the $9 a month seems a bit steep for what the site is. So just a quick rundown. Netlify tracks analytics based on server side data. So there's no JavaScript library that gets put in. And that's really cool because the analytics are better than client side because almost all developers are blocking most of these analytic tools anyway. And it's just very basic analytics, probably enough that you need, but you have to pay the $9. And for some websites, that's a lot to pay, over $100 a year just to add analytics to something. So it's flipping the domain through Cloudflare just for the analytics. It seems crazy, but is it worth it? I'm going to go ahead and say yes. It's not crazy.
Oh, yes, it is worth it. Yes,
it totally is worth it. By putting Cloudflare, you put your DNS on Cloudflare, all your traffic goes through Cloudflare, and they actually give you really good analytics for free. So that is not crazy. That is totally worth it. Alternatives would be awesome. I'd love to get off the Google overload. So we're starting to see this a lot more, is that like all of these cool tools from Google are cool, but a lot of people don't like the fact that they're injecting Google's little tentacles into every single website that we build. And we're starting to see that. What was the other one? HCAPTCHA?
Yeah.
Remember we talked about that one? That was like an alternative to ReCAPTCHA. Quite honestly, I still use Google Analytics. I just don't trust it that much because of the fact that everyone blocks those Google scripts on all of it. So I usually will go for my Cloudflare Analytics because regardless of the type of site that I have, that is giving me the best stats that I have there. You have some other ones here?
Yeah, I have two side options. One for a little bit more basic security focused analytics and then one for a little bit more hefty analytics. Now the heftier one in terms of like being able to track way more things is Heap, heap.io. allows you to track a whole ton of stuff without having Google's grubby fingers on it. You get all sorts of cool stuff from this. You get a lot of great UI out of this application. You can track user flows. To me, this is like a little bit more, it's a little bit more interesting than Google Analytics overall anyways. So I think Heap's a great choice. That said, if you were concerned about the pricing, let's see, Heap is free for limited session volume, 3 months of data history, and one user license on one product. And then let's see, the very next platform is Contact Us. So I don't think it's cheap. So if you want to try it, get started for free. I have used Heap before.
Contact Us is always the most expensive option.
It is. You know what? I used to design, or not design, I used to develop a site for the first agency I worked at, and it was for these trainers. And the trainers, they weren't really that expensive. Like, they were expensive, but in comparing to other exercise equipment, they weren't that expensive. And in no part in the store did they allow us to put the price of the thing anywhere. They just had like a Contact Us for all of the prices. It's like, we built this whole e-commerce store and it had no buy buttons, just Contact Us. And we were just like, come on, put the price on. And then they did a survey about, like, you know, what do you like about the site? What do you don't like about, you know, that kind of thing. They had a third party company, not even us, do a survey for them. And it was like 90% of the responses were like, why can't I just get the price? And their whole reasoning was because they wanted to keep their whole sales team that had been used to like cold calling people. But they refused. And I was just like, come on, just show the price. It's going to turn people off of it.
On SpaceX's website, they give you the price to buy a rocket ship. And everyone's like, well, if they can give you a price on their website to buy a rocket ship, you can tell us how much your SaaS is going to cost.
Yeah, per month. Right. Please. Yeah, please contact us. Okay. Yeah. The next option is an analytics service that I actually use called Fathom. Use Fathom. It's pretty neat. It looks nice. It is a very simple, like in terms of UI interface. It's not intense at all. This is a paid product though as well. However, it's $14 a month for the lowest tier. So it's not exactly cheap. We're paying for the year. So if you're not looking for that $9 one, either way, they're like a very privacy focused analytics company. And I feel good about supporting a small business like this. So
is this Paul Jarvis's company?
It is. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Paul Jarvis is the guy behind Company of One. That's a pretty good book if you want to run a company of one. So this is cool. I like this. I should check this out.
Yeah, I've been using it now for several months, maybe 4 or 5 months, and I like it. I like the UI. I like that it's simple, looks nice. Overall, big fan. And I'm also a big fan of another service that I use every single month, and that is Sentry at sentry.io. Sentry is the best place to track all of your errors and exceptions in one easy-to-use interface. And let me tell you, I've been talking about some of their features. One of their features that I absolutely love that I've mentioned before in here is the performance metrics. Because, hey, why?
It's new, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brand new. And I've been loving it. The interface is really nice. It basically just shows you a table of all of your routes that people hit. Since Sentry is already sort of tracking these errors and exceptions, they can also track the speed at which a took a given route to load. And it even gives you a user misery score. And the coolest thing is you could say, okay, I want to look at which page of mine has the highest failure rate. And okay, I clicked it, and now I see a page that has a high failure rate. In fact, this page, I've never seen this because this just came in, but this page has a 100% failure rate, which means that I have a page somewhere that's being linked that is a page that no longer exists. It's a good opportunity for me to write a redirect to prevent somebody from hitting a 404. Either way, this thing is awesome. I absolutely love it. I'm on here all the time looking at these various routes and seeing which are the slowest routes on my page for real users. So if you want to try this out, head on over to Sentry at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you will get 2 months for free of Sentry today. So thank you very much for Sentry for sponsoring. All right. Next question is from Anon. I have noticed about a dozen to 100 unique clones of my Git repos after each push. It doesn't matter if the repo is initialized, the picture is added or updated, the repos are still cloned. The traffic section shows the views to my repos at one, sometimes two. Is this how interested employers keep tabs on you? Are there some malicious Git users? What is happening? Wes, do you want to take a stab at this one? I thought this was curious.
Yeah. Ooh. So the guy makes a Git repo, and then all of a sudden there's 100 clones of that Git repo immediately.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting out of it. How does he find that out? Is there like a, like if you click on a repo, let's click on one of mine here.
Yeah, if you can see who's cloned that repo, because if you go to a repo, it says in the top right-hand corner how many forks of it.
Yeah.
Which I assume that's what he means.
So at my my site level, scottdolinsky.com has had 8 forks of it. So I have not seen 100 forks of anything that I've done that I wouldn't have expected out of. I don't know. This seems very odd to me.
Yeah, I wish that they gave an example of the repo, because I'd love to dig into the type of people that are doing it. And I would think that the reason people are doing this is that, like, first of all, it's free to clone a repo. And then you also keep the history of something. So if you accidentally push like AWS credentials. So something a lot of bots will do on GitHub is they'll scan for any time somebody accidentally publishes credentials to AWS or Google Cloud or something like that. And then they'll go wild and start mining Bitcoin or sending spam or something like mm-hmm. that.
Do you think that this is like basically the new version of, remember when you used to be able to search code on GitHub and people would just search for API keys via the search functionality? Do you think this is just like the more advanced version of that?
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's what's happening, or like even I'm just trying to think of like how nefarious could you be? Is like somebody is trying to use Git repos as a way to store spam websites or something like that, and Google's maybe GitHub is flagging them if they all of a sudden create hundreds of new Git repos. But if you if you fork somebody else's Git repo and then just blow out whatever they had and put your own stuff in, that's an option. Because I've noticed a lot lately in my GitHub searches, I search on GitHub a lot. Anytime I have a problem with
me too,
how to use an API or anything like that, I'll just search it on GitHub and see other people have implemented it. And I've been finding a lot of like spam in there of people being like, just trying to do SEO stuff with GitHub pages. So I bet there's something shady going on around here, or you're just an extremely popular developer.
Yeah. Those are the two options. It's either shady or you're cool.
All right, next question we have here is from Mark Prime. I really like this question. With Apple,
I really like Mark's name, Mark Prime. It's like
yeah, that's pretty sick. With Apple switching to their own processors, so if you didn't hear, Apple announced that they are no longer going to be building on Intel over. I don't know. I think it's over the next like 3 or 4 years. And they are going to be releasing their own Apple Silicon, which at the end of the day, it's ARM processors. And ARM processors are what are in phones. Is that right?
It's what's in Apple phones. Is that what's in Android phones as well?
Apple makes their own. Apple makes their own chips for the iPhones. So when they came out, I researched it, and they are indeed just ARM-based processors. And those are the processors that are often found in Chromebooks or things like that. And the downside to that is that it doesn't run all of your software, because the apps need to be specifically compiled and built for those types of processors. But the upside to it is that they are cheaper, they're faster, they don't use as much heat. Things like that. Like I know a lot of the supercomputers out there now, instead of using super expensive Xeon processors, they're just using 400 ARM processors distributing the load amongst each other. So that's kind of interesting that they're switching over to that. And I bet that means that we're going to get a MacBook with wicked battery life because they've sort of pinched and squeezed everything they can to get better battery life out of these things. But at a certain point, you need to address the thing that eats all of your battery, and that's your processor. So is it silly for anyone to buy a Mac that is released before that they release those to do development? Do you guys have experience with Windows and which you would still prefer? Which would you still prefer today if you need to buy one? So I don't think that you need to wait for these things to come out, because when they do initially come out, not all of the apps that we know and love are going to immediately work on the new ARM processors, or sorry, Apple Silicon. Let's call it Apple Silicon.
I can't.
So Okay, I'm going to call it Apple Silicone. So it's going to be, I bet it will be a good 5 years or so before everybody has totally transitioned over. And there's going to be a lot of bridge time where you'll have to check if your apps are working on it. And at a certain point, you're not going to get updates for older apps because they'll only work on the new ARM. But I was thinking about that as like, I'm like, okay, well, like, let's just look at the apps that we developers use. We've got a terminal. We have our text editor, like VS Code. You have some sort of design software. You have a browser. Like what else are the apps that we're using? Like screen recorder is a big one for me, and everything terminal that will work on an ARM processor. No problem. An editor that's VS Code's built on Chrome. So that's no sweat there. That's going to work. No problem because these browsers already work on ARM processors. So I bet that will be,
they mentioned that they had somebody to port Electron already.
Really?
Like Electron stuff. So Apple like did it themselves as far as I know.
Oh, that's good. That means like all the apps that I use are based on Electron. So that will work already, especially if the browser's over. Design software. So if you start using Figma, I bet that will work because you can use it in the browser, right?
Yeah. I think Figma is maybe built on Rust. Either way, it's done through. Is it done through Electron? I believe it is. Yeah, at least the app, the desktop app is. But I think as long as it runs in the browser, that stuff should work fine. I think that's some of the joys of writing browser-based applications for us, you know?
Yeah, it's going to be good. I don't think you should wait or stress out about something coming out or not, just because most of you are just sitting at your desk with this thing plugged into a power source anyway. So at some point you will probably get one of these if you decide to go stay with the Mac, but don't sweat about it. I think this is a long-term sort of move. I might be wrong about, but that's what I'm seeing. And in Windows, do you have experience with Windows? Yes. Yeah. Would you go with it? No. It's just, it feels weird. And that's partly because I've been on Mac for so long and partly because every single time we talk about Windows, there's an equivalent of whatever, but it's not as good.
Yeah. None of it's as good. Yes, it's cheaper. You have more options for the hardware, whatever. The OS is still just, cobbled together and like patched on patch on patch. It feels very weird to use. In fact, like they're like beautification aspects of it, like really worked, but it's like, they seems like they only like worked on like the start screen and like the first couple of screens. The moment you get into any like menus in Windows, it all looks like Windows 95 still. It looks terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because we just got finished saying, well, all of this stuff is browser based, so it shouldn't matter. But there is a certain aspect. And I know there's a lot of Windows people screaming at us right now, being like, you're dumb. But that's just how I feel about every time I'm on it. And I've given it like a good, like a couple of weeks on Windows, just trying to make it work. And Just can't make it work.
Yeah, I have a Windows partition on this desk or on this laptop. I've had a Windows machine for a long time. I've used it enough to know exactly how I feel about it. In terms of like, should you wait? In my opinion, I think at least if you're looking to get a MacBook Pro, if you're spending that kind of dinero on a machine, I would wait for the next MacBook Pro. Why? Because I don't think it's that far away. And I think that given the option to be on the Apple Silicon or not, I would take it if you don't need it right now. But if you do need it right now, I think everything that Wes said is going to be fine. I think it would be absolutely more than fine if you were to buy it right now. But let's see, the 16-inch MacBook Pro, according to MacRumors.com, is listed as do not buy because it is past or around their average days since release. And I'm pretty sure the next one that's released is going to have the Apple Silicon. So if it's a matter of waiting, 50 days, man, I would wait. If it's not.
Oh, yeah. Then, I didn't realize it was that. They said late 2020 they're coming. Man, maybe I'm wrong about this. I thought there would be a lot more time. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Time has been an odd thing lately.
Yeah, it's just been like this whole 2020 has just been a fever dream where we wake up with ARM-based Macs.
You bet.
You know what hasn't been a fever dream, Scott?
No. That's you missed the perfect. You missed the perfect transition there.
Show me what you got.
The perfect transition. You say, well, maybe you just want to wait till these MacBooks are refreshed, and you will be certainly refreshed when you try out one of the freshest the services that we've ever advertised here on Syntax, and that's FreshBooks.
Yes, FreshBooks is your cloud accounting that you need for your independent, freelance, small business, big business, whatever it is. If you need to keep track of invoices, expenses, time tracking, all of that good stuff.
Maybe you bought a laptop.
Maybe you bought a laptop and you need to put that thing in, or maybe you need to, what's it called? Depreciate it over 4 years because it was a large expense. You can do that with FreshBooks. So check it out at freshbooks.com/syntax. They'll get you 30-day unrestricted free trial. Make sure you use Syntax in the How Did You Hear About Us box. And thanks so much to FreshBooks for sponsoring.
Nice. All right. Next question is from Paige Niederinghaus. She says, hi. Hey, Wes and Scott, big fan of the podcast. Thank you, Paige. My question is, have you ever been approached by or heard of getads.io? They're trying to pay developers to put ads onto popular open source libraries on GitHub. They approached me recently. I wasn't sure what to think about them. It just seems fishy, and I thought there was a little chatter about it on Twitter. What do you think? I know the sponsorship ads help pay the bills, but I don't know if it conflicts with GitHub's terms of service or how developers would react. Not reacting to us. Since typically we're more suspicious of things that seem sponsored or disingenuous. Thanks for any thoughts or advice you have, Paige. Yes, I have not heard of this company. That seems kind of iffy to me. You know what? I personally, if we're talking about personally and somebody wants to throw in a one-liner, you know, if you want to help support this repo, here's like, watch this ad. Like, I honestly, for the amount of software that I use that other people have written, I can overlook that in my GitHub logs or my NPM installs. I really do not care personally if people want to do this kind of thing. But I don't know, a company approaching you independently and being like, hey, can we throw some ads on your stuff? Like, that to me seems kind of rough. I don't know. It seems shady to me.
Yeah, I actually have a lot of experience with this just because like back when I first did my affiliate thing, there was another like startup. I forget who it was. I'm just searching my emails. It was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And they did this exact same thing where they implemented an SVG file and then that SVG file would dynamically change on their server and serve up just text. That would be an ad. And they approached me and said, hey, do you want to buy a bunch of inventory? And I said, no, but we can try it with a like a affiliate. And he put me in a bunch of his unused inventory and really nothing came of it. So it didn't really work that well. And then I also had Sindre Sorhus. Is that how you say it? He's the dev behind. Yeah. Dev behind like millions, all these awesome lists, tons of different plugins and JavaScript things and whatnot. And just did a horizontal rule and then did a little ad. It says, improve your JavaScript skills with this ESX course from Wes Boss. Try his free JavaScript quarters, JavaScript 30 course for a taste of what to expect. You might also like his React and Sublime courses. And then another horizontal rule. And that did super well for him. I've paid out, I don't know, a couple $1,000 to him just from those little clean little ads that he's put in the readme of his repo. And every couple of months, somebody would screenshot and be like, hey, what the hell is this? And then we would reply, be like, oh, the guy's given his entire life to open source. Sorry.
Hey, you read all this free stuff and somebody put one line of something that's not free and you lose. Yeah, I had a lot of experience with that on YouTube. I did 2,000 free videos and then I asked people to pay for one and they were like, what's the deal here?
Yeah. So, and then that worked. And when we said that, a lot of people sort of came to it and be like, wow, that's really cool that you're able to, like, I'm able to teach people. He's able to get a little extra money from the stuff that he's been building. And that like sort of funds him to keep working on this stuff. So it was a pretty good arrangement. I did hear that first one I talked about was against GitHub's terms and they got shut down for that. I've never had any issues with mine. So I think as long as it's like
or organic, you doing it yourself.
Yeah. As long as it feels cool, it is kind of weird when a company comes in and starts trying to drop ads into readmes and things like that. But there's probably there's a problem here. And that is that open source authors need to make money somehow. And I think people are trying to figure out how does that work right now. And this is just one of those things. So you probably won't make a whole lot of money off of it unless you have like Sindre has. He's probably one of the most popular developers on all of GitHub. And it's not like unreal how much money he's made. But if you just have like a couple of popular repos, you probably won't make a whole lot of money for it. And I would say it's probably not worth it.
Yeah, right. I don't know. It's a tough call. I've not heard of this company, though. I don't know. I would prefer if it was me to do it on like a more personal basis than like through some totally. Company that's just going to throw some stuff on there.
Next question from Colby H. I just listened to your TLD game. And it made me wonder, what are your opinions on personal site domains? Should you always try to be yourname.dev? What about .me or other domain names? This is really interesting. So like what are the popular ones for developers? We have .io, .dev, which is pretty new. It only came out, 6 months ago? .me, there's .tech, which is a sponsor of our podcast. .sh is a popular one. .com. So what should you always go to? No, you don't have to get a .dev. Everyone used to always try to go for the IO. Those are mostly taken up now. And then also anytime you mention it, somebody comes at you and talks about how awful IOs are. Apparently they're sinking the ocean or something. What was the problem with IO?
I thought it was a foreign country. Is that accurate? I thought it was a foreign country and there was like some weirdness around SEO or something.
No, it's not, because those country level domains, Google has a list of, these are country level domains, but we don't treat them as country level domains. Like .tv is for Tuvalu, but they don't treat it as like, oh, this website must be originating in Tuvalu. Somebody is abusing the country, I think. We can look into it. Maybe we'll put a link in the show notes if I find it. I don't forget what it is offhand. Dev is cool. They seem to be very expensive, especially if you want a short one. .me. I've never liked .me. What do you think about me's?
Don't like it.
No. It reminds me of Apple for some reason.
Does it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like, I think there was like some service that was like your homepage. It was like around, trying to be a fancy, this is your landing page. This is your business card for the web. And that's what it reminds me of for some reason.
Oh yeah. And .sh is pretty cool. .com.
I use .com. Yeah.
Yeah. I think my favorite is if you can't get the .com because your name is like Joe Smith, I would try to go for the .sh or try to make some like really cool domain name off of it. Otherwise, nothing wrong with the .dev or something like that.
Yeah, I use .com. I've just had scotttolinsky.com forever. Although I do have stolinsky.dev, which isn't as like, fun as scotttolinsky.com. Yeah. But it is like, I don't know, my Twitter handle, all my handles are stolinsky everywhere. So maybe stolinsky.dev should be my main URL just to fall in line with everything else. I've never thought about that too much. But yeah, I would go com, tech, dev before IO, me, or SH, but that's just me. Last question here is from Cam. Cam says, what's the best way to introduce new technology or process to a team? I have a lot of ideas about this, but that said, I think it's going to be different based on how big your team is. Big teams, it's a little bit more interesting or difficult. Small teams, these get a little bit more intimate and one-on-one. You can do a lunch and learn where everybody brings their lunch. One person is presenting. Everybody eats their lunch because they're in the same room and everybody has lunch at the same time. You eat your lunch and one person gives a little presentation about a specific topic. That's one. Two, in an internal mini conference, that'd be fun. You take a day and every single person on your dev team prepares a miniature talk about something that they found interesting. That way it gets people really used to sharing things that they know and love. So a little mini conference or a miniature meetup is the same as a lunch and learn, except for it's an all day and everybody would take a turn. Demo day. And I don't mean like a full day, but maybe you've prepared a code demo and you could pass along this demo and say, hey, look at this thing. Maybe it's a problem that your team has typically or whatever. And look at how elegantly I solved it using this technology. Maybe we should look into using this technology for things. That way people can really get a firsthand view of just what problem this thing is solving and how eloquently it's solving it. Another one would be to get everybody in the room and watch a talk on YouTube. I think this is fun. I know people who have done Wes's Wes's courses like this, that where they'll all sit and they'll do like a lunch and learn where they'll all put on Wes's courses together in the conference, the thing. Well, maybe you're not good at speaking and you don't care about speaking, but somebody else has already done a really awesome talk or tutorial or whatever. Well, you could say, hey, everybody, I have this really great lunch and learn idea. Let's go ahead and do this. Now, I think all of these approaches require buy-in from the whole team. And I think this is the type of thing where you would really want to have your boss, the blessings of your boss, to say like, yes, this is what we're going to do. And we're maybe going to make it a regular thing. That way people can get used to constantly sharing what they're learning and passing along information in that sort of way. And that way you'll have a stronger development team. In my experience, teams that work more like this, they're more communicative. They're more like, let's learn from each other. Like, that's our biggest strength, is that we have all these brains. So we might as well use these brains to help the other brains, you know. So for me, these kind of things really would be a good solution for something like this.
Yeah, I agree. I love seeing teams, or I've even seen just friends, like a couple times now I've seen people get together with people in their city and they rent a conference room, or go in somebody's work has a conference room, and they all do like 3 or 4 or 5 parts of one of my courses, JavaScript 30 or something like that. And they do it all together. And it's really cool because you can pause and talk through it together and say like, oh, this is how we might approach that on our team instead. And sometimes you have a more senior developer who already knows what they're doing. They can talk to the junior ones. So just like, not everyone has time to create mini talks and things like that. Those are awesome. But if you don't have time to do that, like Scott said, just grab some pre-made content. Even just grabbing a conference talk that's on YouTube and watching it together while you eat your lunch is an awesome way to go forward with that.
Cool. Well, that's it for this potluck. Now we're going to get into the part of the show called Sick Picks, where we pick something that we think is sick.
Man, I got the best sick pick of my... I'm going to say this is the best sick pick of my life. Ooh, besides pre-cut parchment paper. Oh, I don't even know. This borders on pre-cut parchment paper.
Is this the type of sick pick that you're going to have where I'm going to ask you like 6 months later, like, hey, where'd you buy that? And you're like, it was a sick pick, man.
It happens all the time.
It does.
But you can't. I can't expect you to remember every pick that is sick.
I got a bad memory.
But here it is. It is rollerblade wheels for your office chair. Boom. Okay, so I did not know about this until about 2 months ago. Somebody on Twitter was like, they saw a picture of my office. And they said, hey, watch that laminate with your Herman Miller Aeron chair. It'll cut that up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, he's like, go get, like, I'm like, I don't want one of those stupid little mats that you have to put underneath. He said, get rollerblade wheels. So I was like, what? So you can get these like really nice wheels with like ABAC 40s in them. These things are fast. And you turn your chair over, you pull your old wheels out, you slap these things in. It's like $30 or $20 American for a set. They have 11 millimeters fit almost every chair, and then 10 millimeter one will fit IKEA chairs, and it makes your chair like so much smoother to glide around on. And I feel like the chair is just more comfortable in general, because like sometimes you can't get your chair over like just an inch if you just need to like just shift your weight around, and this just rolls everywhere with you. And that sounds like a bad thing, but this is like a life changer. I tweeted it out and like it had like 1200 retweets, and I had like hundreds of people being like a couple weeks later being like, this is the best thing ever. So major upgrade. I always talk to people like, what's the best upgrade you can get in your life for under $100? And this is up there with one of the best upgrades. So rollerblade wheels, you can get them on Amazon and they fit pretty much any chair.
Yeah, that is very sick. I have like a ruggable rug underneath my desk that I'm constantly hitting the edge of. That is a very sick pick. That is one that I will be purchasing. So thank you very much for that. I have I have a wealth of sick picks that I've been collecting here. Let me pick a really sick one. Now, this one is going to be sick for any of you who have the 16-inch MacBook Air. So I'm sorry, that is going to be a small segment of this audience, but this pick is sick enough that I will make an exception here. This isn't my greatest sick pick of all time, but this is one for 16-inch MacBook Pro people that you will find useful. So this is called Disable Turbo Boost. This is an application for the Mac. And so with these new Macs, I don't know if you've noticed this, Wes, but the fans come on way sooner. The fans come on very soon, and that's because of Turbo Boost. Now, Turbo Boost has a whole bunch of different effects. And if you're sitting there, you know, with your computer plugged in and whatever recording, the last thing you want is your microphone to pick up some of that noise coming off of your fans, or you don't want your fans to be going nuts. So either way, there is a neat little app that allows you to one click to disable Turbo Boost until you want to turn it back on. And I found this to be just a really, really nice application to have on my computer. I'll put a link in the show notes. But again, if you have a Turbo Boost Mac, this allows you to control your fans a little bit better in a way that just is the way it probably should have been working. But I think Apple's doing it the fans on very early for specific reasons.
Does this stop that your processor from working too hard, or does this just turn the fans off? Because people are always like, use this app to turn your fans off. I'm like, well, they're on for a reason, aren't they? Like, yeah. It needs to be cooled. Like, I don't want to like fry this thing.
So, okay. So all it does is disable the Turbo Boost. Your fans will stay on. It doesn't just shut off your fans. It's basically, let's see, the MacBook runs noticeably cooler and gains 25% in battery life. So this person says it's running cooler and it gains more in battery life. I don't necessarily understand it. All I know is that I click button and my fans cool down a little bit. I click button says, okay, fans cool down and my recordings sound better.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I never, everyone always asks me, hey, is your fans on a lot? And I'm like, I don't know, because I have my noise canceling headphones on all day. Let me see. Oh yeah, mine's like a rocket ship right now.
Yeah, that gets picked up in the recording for me at least, so.
Oh,
like when I start to talk and the gate's down, I don't know if it's maybe my microphone's too close to the computer comparatively.
Yeah, I think I've had it before where it was. And I just, when I put it on, like I have mine off to the side beside my monitor. So that might be the difference of how far it is from the mic.
Yeah,
cool. That's cool. I'm going to get that though. Because yeah, sometimes mine's just like, ah!
Yeah,
like, stop. This is so obnoxious.
Very obnoxious. And I was happy to find out that I could turn it off.
Wow, maybe those new MacBooks will not be so hot. That'd be good. I'm kind of excited about them now.
I know, right? Who wants a 16-inch MacBook Pro that I just bought?
We did an entire episode on the new MacBooks, and I said you probably should have this thing for 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
To make it worth it.
Yes.
So now I gotta sit and wait.
Sit and wait.
All right. Shameless plugs. What do you got for me?
Shameless plugs. Wow. It's so long since we recorded one of these. I have two courses. I did a course on 3D in React. We should maybe do an episode on 3D in React because it's very cool.
Yes.
You can work with real 3D stuff. I don't know if you've noticed, but 3D has been popping up all over the place. Even the new Stripe website has 3D. So if you want to learn how they did that and you want to learn all about how to use 3D on the web, specifically with React, we did this course on React 3 Fiber, which is an incredible library using 3.js. And the course for this month is going to be Advanced Animating with Framer Motion. So, man, a lot of like really, really cool courses that I've been working on. That's going to be out. Does August have 31 days in it? If so, August 31st. If not, then whatever the last day of August is. Nice little conditional there.
August.pop.
Yes, August.pop. Yes. Negative one. It's the last item in August. And so those are the two courses that we're doing. Head on over to leveluptutorials.com and check it out. If you sign up for Level Up Pro, you get all of those courses plus many, many more. Sign up for the year and save 25%. Thank you so much.
I'm going to shamelessly plug my upcoming Gatsby course. It probably won't be up by the time you listen to it. Maybe. It's going to be at mastergatsby.com. I'm really excited about it because it's the first course I've done where we also write all of the CSS. People always ask me like, can you please include the CSS? And for a lot of my stuff, it's just been like, well, no, that would add an extra 30 hours to the,
yeah,
to the course. But for this one, it was actually possible. And then I made it skippable for those who don't care about the CSS. You can skip it. It's really cool. We're using Sanity as a headless CMS. We're using Gatsby, obviously, for the entire website. There's a lot of custom React hooks that we've thrown in there, serverless functions, all that good stuff. So get ready for that. It's going to be available at mastergatsby.com. And that's it.
Sweet.
All right. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you on Monday.
Monday.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.